Today, we are finishing the Old Testament section of our Smarter, Stronger series, and I wanted to recap some important things, kind of remind you where we are as we leave the Old Testament and start to go into the New Testament age, and I wanted to remind you how those things relate to so many other things that are happening in the world all at the same time. So I've prepared this grid for you on page 256, and it shows you what Israel is doing, what else is happening throughout Asia, particularly the Far East, and what's happening in Europe, and you kind of just see it all side by side to get a feel for what it's like to live in the world during those dates. And then on the backside, we're going to talk about some of the great themes that we've discovered over the last year or so, talking about the Old Testament. So on the front side, where this table is prepared for you, you see that we have some dates in the left-hand column. And let me just remind you what's been happening in the world since 1000. 1000 is about the time when Saul is inaugurated. So that gives you an idea from Saul to the time of Christ is what we're trying to achieve here. So you see on the Israel side of the Israel column, the kingdom years of Israel can be counted from the coronation of Saul, about 1050, until the fall of Jerusalem, 605 BC. During this time, the Israelite nations, in some cases, because we have Judah and Israel separated, they exert significant influence in the Middle East. That cradle of civilization long ago, it was always thought that the cradle of civilization was the Middle East, and particularly in the area of Iraq. And that's because when we read about the location of the Garden of Eden, it says that it's very near the Tigris River. And so we think, okay, well, we know where that is. They're talking about Iraq. And so the Middle East, Mesopotamian area, that's the part between the Tigris and the Euphrates River above the Persian Gulf, that is biblically the cradle of civilization. And things grow from there. At any rate, Israel sometimes exerts a tremendous amount of influence in the Middle East, sometimes not so much. And you can see during this kingdom period, in the age of Solomon, there was significant influence, and in other ages, perhaps almost no influence. But that's what's happening in the Middle East. In Asia, and sometimes we would even think of the Middle East as the Orient. Classic authors often talk about David, for example, as an Oriental king. So defining the Middle East and the Far East is a little smushy sometimes. But in Asia, you have Egypt, Assyria, Syria, and Phoenicia waxing and waning in dominance. They rise and fall. The Far East, including China and India, generally remains slightly behind the Middle East in learning. So what is happening is that the cradle of civilization, knowledge is growing, and sometimes it spills over to the Far East and sometimes spilling over into other areas that we would call Turkey. For example, the Hittite Empire was in Turkey. And so all of that is happening, almost touching Europe, getting way over by India. And if you imagine the influence spreading that way. Not much is happening in Europe, though. The Middle East and the Far East are just about the only games in town. You see, iron tools and weapons on the Israel column begin to replace bronze in about 1000 BC. And that's the same as well in the Asia column. Hittites make iron products as early as 1700. But throughout the Mesopotamian area, iron tools and weapons begin to replace bronze in about 1000. And once again, not much happening in Europe. If you get to the 900 BC and 800 BC time frame, and a little bit more recent than that, you see in the Israel column, Jonah preaches against the capital of Assyria, that's Nineveh, in about 780. That's about 60 years before Assyria actually conquers the 10 northern tribes of Israel. So it gives you an idea of what's happening. Israel is not significant, and Assyria is on the ascendancy. On the Asia side, in the Asia column, history's first ever naval battle takes place in the Mediterranean Sea when Tyre defeats Assyria in 725 BC. So you actually have a navy attacking. And on the right-hand side, Europe, learning from the Hittites, remember, because Turkey is leaning right over against Europe. And so learning from the Hittites, the Phoenicians, the Egyptians, because of that, that is outpacing what's taking place in Eastern Europe. But in Greece, things are starting to come together. So we have city-states rising in Greece around 750 BC, some organized, respectable powers in Greece, and the first Olympic Games in 776. The city of Rome is founded as a legitimate city in 753. So you can see all of this is happening about the time of Jonah. Well, go a little further down in the Asia column. You see the Assyrian Empire peaks from 750 to 612. And that's why the 10 tribes of Israel go into Assyrian captivity during that time, 722. Again, in the Asia column, according to Herodotus, he lives in the 400s BC. The Persians were almost entirely nomadic until the 600s BC. So if you picture this, we have the 10 northern tribes of Israel going into captivity in 722 BC. Pretty soon, the Babylonians and the Medes and the Persians start to get things together. And it's going to be just a question of time. And the Babylonians, the Medo-Persian kingdom, representing Babylon, eventually the same area, will start to jockey for power. Sometimes the Assyrians rise and they're very strong. And then the Babylonians rise and they're very strong. Then the Medo-Persians rise and they're very strong. And all that's happening in exactly the same territory. Well, okay, so on the Israel side, about 600 BC, these are the captivity years of Judah. And they go from 606 when Daniel was hauled off as their early royalty to 536 when Cyrus says the first people can return back to the Holy Land if they want to. So those are the captivity years. Well, Babylon is all the rage in 606 for world religions. You see, Zoroastrianism is now firmly entrenched in Persia, which again is what we would call Iran. Today, if you ask the Iranians, are you Arabs? They'll say, no, we're Persians. They want to be known as Persians, and so they are. But he founds Zoroaster, founds Zoroastrianism, the religion after his name, in which a good God and a bad God work under one supreme God. And that's what the probably the wise men from the East were indoctrinated in. They were probably in that. They were Persians, most likely. And so all that is about the time Daniel goes into captivity. So those are the captivity years. 500 BC. Well, the post-captivity years, because from 536 forward to the time of Christ, you have Jewish people back in the Holy Land, right? Well, you see the grid there of all that's taking place. 538, Cyrus beats Babylon. Cyrus the Medes, so the Medo-Persian Empire, conquers Babylon. He says the Jewish people can go back to the Holy Land if they want to. 536, the first wave goes back. 521, you have another king, some drama that goes with that, with the rebuilding of Israel. 520, Haggai the prophet. 518, Zechariah the prophet. 515, the temple is done. 486, Xerxes and the Jews falsely accused again of insurrection. That's not true. 479, Esther's crisis. Sorry for the misspelling. 464, Artaxerxes takes the throne. This is Nehemiah's lifetime. 458, second wave of captives return with Ezra. 450, Malachi. 444, third wave of captives return with Nehemiah. Nehemiah's return to Jerusalem, 430, and then we have the 400 silent years, where basically there are no more books written for the Old Testament, and we haven't arrived at the New Testament yet. On the Asia side, in the Asia column, you see Confucianism is founded, and this is about 500 BC in China. You see that Buddha converts from ancient Hinduism. He himself was a Hindu convert, Buddha, and then the others were forthcoming. And basically, there's very little difference between Hinduism and Buddhism. Buddhism is a little more sophisticated. So a good Buddhist would not like to have lots of gods, idols all around him. But he's not terribly opposed to that either. And in Hinduism, there was oftentimes a lot of brutality. And Buddhists tend to want to be more peaceful with their lifestyles. But they're essentially the same with those several differences. And so we have Buddhism rising in about 500 BC. Once again, imagine the time of Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, and you're approximately at the founding of Buddhism. So that's where the world is in that time. If you skip down then to about 200 BC, you see on the Israel column, things are getting rough in the Holy Land. This is the Maccabean period when you have Syrian tyrants tormenting the Jewish people who live in the Holy Land. You see that's from about 167 to 160 BC in particular. That forms the basis of the priest-ruled Hasmonean dynasty. So that's why you have people in power as they are when Jesus is born. The priests are not just holy men. They are the bosses. And it's because the Maccabees were not only priests, but generals in the army. And so the idea was born that the priest would be essentially the king, and the priest class would be the royal class. And that's basically how we find things in the opening of the New Testament. On the far right-hand side, some things have been brewing in Europe, and this is obviously important for the New Testament, because now the Greek Empire rises in 330 BC. That's Alexander the Great conquering the world in essentially 3 years. And then the Greek Empire sort of dissipates. The Roman Empire rises in 27 BC. It lasted 476 AD, so the long-running Roman Empire. And that's what was happening in the world. So when we talk about what's going on in the Old Testament, it's not like the Jewish people were the only ones who existed in those days. There is stuff happening all around the world. But you notice that not very much good news is happening anywhere except in the Holy Land. So does that raise any questions or observations just to get a feel for all of that? All right, now if you turn that page over, we want to talk about some of the great lessons that we have come across in the Old Testament continuously since we started doing our Smarter, Stronger series. The first one we have there is the utter mastery of God in the universe. And just look at my little description there. God is the universe's creator, judge, and moment-by-moment caretaker. No one is ever in a position to call into question any of God's ideas or his actions, and no serious challenge to his power has ever existed in any time or place. Remember, Job said, "I will lay my hand upon my mouth." He thought that he had some complaints he would like to offer up to God as to how he's been treated. And when the time came for him to actually stand in the presence of the Lord, he said, "I think I'll put my hand over my mouth. I have nothing to say." So the utter mastery of God in the universe. Remind me then, what ideas come to your mind when we talk about God being the total master of the universe? What did we see from Genesis to Malachi to talk about the greatness of God in the world of men? Joanne. Yeah. So Joanne is saying such huge stories, our heroes, with Joseph and Daniel. And the Lord was ruling in the affairs of those men even when things looked really, really bad. Other examples, what strikes you as being remarkable in the Old Testament in describing God? Bob? Good. Keep going. Good. So the whole life of Moses, the 10 plagues, the Exodus event with the Red Sea crossing and all that. Egypt was the world's undisputed superpower, and it really didn't help very much at all, did it, against God. God is the master, not the Pharaoh. Good. What else did we find? Josiah. There is creation. So to grasp the greatness of God, to spin the worlds into space. If we go very, very large, then how did the Lord make a sun like our sun that is just bursting with energy. I mean, it's so powerful. And if we go very, very small, how did the Lord make the atoms work and the cells and the human eye and the human brain? Just amazing. God is the master of the universe. And everywhere in the Old Testament that we turn, we get another lesson about that over and over again. God is utterly the master of the universe. Amy. Yeah, very good. That's right. Fulfilled prophecies are just uncanny how there would be such a lot of detail, especially messianic prophecy. Great. Sharla. Very good. Yes. The whole story of Noah, which is, you know, it's mind-boggling because we are not only seeing the rainfall, miraculous rainfall, the complete depopulation of the earth, and then the grace to put it all back together again. I mean, it's extraordinary. Scientists say that there's this bathtub ring all over the globe. Wherever you go, you can see that our world was underwater. And that is the mastery of God in the universe. Good. The next thing I have here on the list is the frightening power of God. And my little description there, God is hidden from, trembled at, collapsed before, and fled from. Humans have died in his presence and come to life again by his permission. He has flashed, thundered, burned, blinded, crippled, and slaughtered throughout biblical history. I mean, everywhere we go in the Old Testament, God is frighteningly powerful. And, you know, we may not like to think of that in our current politically correct nation, but whenever people have an encounter with God, it is a frightening encounter. Even if they are friends of God, you know, no less a person than Moses said, "I exceedingly fear and quake." Even Moses. And God spoke with Moses face to face. But God is frighteningly powerful. And you get this in the Old Testament everywhere. So give me ideas. When was God frighteningly powerful? When did that happen? Genesis to Malachi. Justin. Passover, the angel of death. Very good. Another example, Josiah. Sodom and Gomorrah, of course. Yeah, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Another example, Rod. Yeah, Riot is talking about the Lord's graciousness to always warn people this is coming, and they didn't seem to listen so well. But yeah, almost every story has a warning component to it. Tom? Tom is talking about what the various peoples of the world who don't believe in the Bible think about language. You know, why did language evolve? And did Adam speak Hebrew? I wouldn't be surprised if Adam spoke Hebrew. We can't prove that, but I wouldn't be surprised. Interestingly, it's common for people who study Middle Eastern languages to see a lot of similarities between, for example, Hebrew and the languages of cuneiform in Babylon and such. And a lot of times an expert in Hebrew will also be an expert in one of the other ancient languages or several ancient languages because they are really related. So I wouldn't be surprised in the cradle of civilization if Hebrew were the original language. Other religions and other evolutionary scientists don't really have any suggestion for how the languages evolved and which one might be first, as far as I know. And so Hebrew may very well have been the language of the Garden of Eden. We don't know. Maybe. Good. Okay, so frightening power of God. Did you know? Well, of course you did notice, but all of those things, Adam has sinned, now Adam hides. Jonah is sinning by running away from God. There's a terrible storm. The sailors are afraid. They throw him in, and the storm is calmed. In the case of Gideon, approached by the angel of the Lord, he's awestruck. Samson's parents are awestruck. Abraham runs and falls on his face and bows down when the Lord and the two angels visit. The Bible stories are replete with this idea that though God is good, he is frightening. He has frightening power. He's not the kid next door. He should not be teased. He shouldn't be taunted, and he shouldn't be taken for granted. And the Old Testament is really wonderful. Basically, every great Bible story that you have ever heard in Sunday school has an element of fright to it. You know, Daniel is rescued from the lion's den, but the guys who concocted the scheme to put him in the lion's den aren't rescued. And they throw those fellows in the lion's den. And the way it reads, they don't even hit the floor of the den because the lions leap and devour them. So that's frightening. And every great Bible story you know has God doing something frightening. It's just what you see from Genesis to Malachi. The waywardness, Josiah. Good. Was that the 134th Psalm? 130 verse 4. Josiah is reminding us of the verse in the Psalm that says, with the Lord there is forgiveness that he may be feared. And that is right. The beauty of all of this is that the Lord is gentle and good and loving, and frightening power of God should still be recognized. The waywardness of humankind. From the fall of Adam to the spiritual coldness of captive Israel, humans display their depravity at every turn. Jeremiah 17:9. You probably know that from Awana. Let's all say it together. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? So here we have the desperate wickedness. Like, are you serious? Those Israelites are going to rebel again? Is this really happening? You've got to be kidding. Why would they do that? And yet we find it in all of our great Bible stories again. You know, Daniel is amazing, but his fellow Israelites are not. Of course, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are. But so many of the Jewish people evidently just caved in and bowed down and worshiped Nebuchadnezzar's idol. And then you just have three who don't. Daniel apparently out of town or something. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego don't worship the idol. But everybody else seems to. It's not like all of the people who were brought captive from Judah are faithful. Just the three. Not very many. The waywardness of humankind. Over and over again, we find this in Scripture. The next one, the incessant intervention of God in the everyday affairs of humankind. So, God directs the animals to gather, the rains to fall, the crops to grow, the sling stones to fly straight, the devil to cease, the kings to act, and the nations to fall. Although the vast majority of God's activities are invisible, 2 Kings 6:17 has Elisha saying, Lord, open his eyes so that the servant could see that there was an angel army. Lord, open his eyes. Even though most of God's activities are invisible, his many historical responses to prayer are remarkable. So that's what's so interesting about the Lord intervening in the affairs of men. So you can say, well, rain falls because of the water cycle. The sun evaporates the water. It gets stuck on the little dust particles. When there's enough of that, there's a cloud. When there's enough of that, there's rain. And down the water comes, and up it goes, and around. So it's not God. And yet, we see it is God. God said, you disobey me, and I'll withhold the rain. The story of Elijah with Ahab's kingdom. You will not obey me, I will withhold the rain. The water cycle is not going to work for you. So we get so cocky because we have a scientific explanation. And yet God says, no, I'm doing that. I control the rain. I control the day-to-day events of the world and individuals in the world. So give me some of your favorite instances where the Lord is incessantly intervening in everyday things. When did that happen? Dana. Great. Yes, a great story. The axe head falls in the water, and then by a miracle of God, it swims. It floats up, and they grab it up, and a borrowed axe head is returned. Good. How else? When else did that happen? Joanne? Right. The whole providence of God in the story of Esther, particularly when she approaches the king, taking her life in her hands. Very good. When else did it happen? Josiah? Yeah, very good. So Josiah is saying the whole story of Joseph and the fall into, you know, slavery, dungeon, and then the rise again to be a ruler in Egypt to save the nation. Vernon. Very good. Yes. Vernon is saying even turning the king's heart, as in the book of Proverbs, he holds the king's heart in his hand. And he even influenced the kings to do certain things at certain times. And yeah, that was so fascinating how the Lord caused Pharaoh to have favor on Joseph, and the Lord caused Nebuchadnezzar to have favor on Daniel, and Xerxes to have favor on Esther, and Cyrus to allow the children of Israel to go back to the Holy Land if they want to. Uncanny. The Lord is moving in the politics of mankind and affecting everyday lives. James. Good. Yeah, the whole story of Jonah with the super whale, the super gourd, and the repentance of Nineveh, the whole thing is just miraculous. Amy. Yeah, good. The story of Moses in the basket being discovered and taken care of by the princess. Pretty amazing. Good. Chris. Yeah, the Lord's protection of David many times on one occasion when Saul has him hemmed in and then Saul is called away and has to do something else. Very good. So that's what we see in all of our great Bible stories, God intervening in the affairs of men. And just because you have a scientific explanation, oh, that's the water cycle, that doesn't mean that God wasn't superintending and organizing the whole thing. All right, halfway down the page. The loving favor God extends toward obedient individuals. This is everywhere. So the scarlet thread of an innocent life being sacrificed in the place of a guilty soul can be found in the stories of every Old Testament hero from Adam to Malachi. And by God's outstretched hand, people are fed, protected from armies, helped in poverty, aided in illness, introduced to their companions, and exalted beyond any naysayer's wildest expectations. So beyond the scarlet thread, the blood-colored thread of sacrifice being made so that people who are guilty could go free, beyond that, which is everywhere in the sacrifice system of Old Testament Israel, beyond that, you just have the Lord rescuing people all the time. He rescues them from enemies, from hunger, from plagues and diseases. He rescues them all the time. And beyond any expectations of their enemies, the enemies were consistently shocked, surprised. How did this happen? And sometimes they were so shocked and surprised that out of their minds, they turned on each other and killed each other and let the Israelites go. So, yeah, the Lord is just helping people all the time, saving, rescuing, delivering. It's just what he does. The next one. The privilege of Israelite lineage. From God's call on Abraham until the close of Malachi, the Jewish people enjoyed a virtual monopoly on the special favor of God. Thankfully, any non-Jew who wished to be part of God's covenant family could become so by conversion. In the book of Esther, after their great victory, it says, and many of the people of the land became Jews. Well, you can't, be born suddenly into a Jewish mother. That means they converted to Jewishness. And that's great, because what we're saying is that we find a special people chosen by God from the time of Abraham and chosen in such a way that they keep getting special favor, second chances and third chances and 100 chances. And we find that all the way through the prophets who are saying that even now those people are in line for very special privileges. So we find that everywhere in the Old Testament, beginning in Genesis 12 with the call of Abraham. Does that raise any questions or observations, Joe? That's a great story. Yeah, Joe is reminding us that the scarlet thread idea is really from Rahab tying the scarlet thread on her window to mark it as a safe place when the walls of Jericho would fall. And it's amazing to see the person who's not a nice person, a harlot, not only rescued in the fall of Jericho, but also ending up in the ancestry of David and therefore Christ. Pretty great. All right, the second to the bottom heading. The certainty of paradise conditions on earth again when Messiah comes. The whole Old Testament reminds us that the earth experiment is going on and it will not be allowed to fail. And Abraham's search for a better country, a city whose builder and maker is God, will prove to be fruitful after all when Messiah comes to earth and makes the wolf lie down with the lamb. So you're reading all about these earthly things. And you think, wow, the earth experiment. Once Satan enters and Adam sins and Cain kills his brother and on we go. What a disaster, what utter chaos. And then we find, oh, actually, the prophets say on earth it's going to be paradise again. Everything's going to be fine. And the prophets trumpet this over and over and over again. And we see that paradise conditions will be restored. One more at the bottom of the page. The opportunity to dwell in the house of the Lord forever at death. While it's true that there aren't a lot of mentions of this in the Old Testament, from Genesis to Malachi, there are a fairly good number and well worth noticing. So, our explanation, when the saints gave up the ghost to be gathered unto their people, as the Old Testament would say it so often, they weren't annihilated and they didn't cease to exist. They simply departed this world for another so they might dwell in the house of the Lord forever, knowing even that in their resurrected flesh they would one day again see God. That's what Job said, in my flesh I shall see God. And so in the Old Testament you have this huge lesson, this important lesson that when you die, that's not the end. Death is a departure. You leave this world for another world, and as the Psalms said it, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And that is a huge lesson. So you put all these together, the utter mastery of God in the universe, the frightening power of God, the waywardness of humankind, the incessant intervention of God in the everyday affairs of humankind, the loving favor God extends toward obedient individual, the privilege of Israelite lineage, the paradise conditions on earth that will be restored, the opportunity to dwell in the house of the Lord forever at death. Every one of those lessons is huge, so important, and if you grasp that, you have a pretty good start on the skeleton of the Old Testament. So next week, not next week because we have home fellowship groups, the following week we're going to begin the New Testament. Does that raise any questions or observations before we stop? Tom. Yeah, Tom is saying, you know, how many animals must have been sacrificed over this 4,000-year period? And our critics do say that's such a bloody religion. How violent, how cruel, and how primitive. You know, it's like those people are a bunch of primitives. And why would the Lord have that as such a central component to the religion of the Bible? And I think some of what we have here, the frightening power of God, has a lot to do with it. Death is central to everything in the religion of the Bible. The whole point of redemption is that you're being redeemed from something really, really bad. The point of salvation is you're being saved from something really, really bad. And death, that absence from God, it's sort of like, maybe it's a little bit like a human relationship that you treasure the most and it goes bad. There's been a breakup. There's been a divorce. Maybe there's been some sort of a child rebellion against a parent. And the person who's offended would probably say, that has defined my life. That changed everything. Well, death is separation from God. It's the departure from God because you chose another lover, the devil, and your own sins. So you left God for a paramour, and that's not a small thing to God. So you left me, and the departure from God ultimately is hell. Depart from me, you cursed, into everlasting fire. So we're talking about departure from God, death being central to everything God thinks about all the time in his relationship with us. Nothing is more important than that human beings departed. They chose a different lover. And that's not little. That's the whole game. So death pictures it. You know, do you see that animal? What do you think about that? That's pretty awful, isn't it? Think about that. That's death, death, death. And that's how God feels about it. So I think we would like to pretend that death isn't coming. But death is coming. And every time an animal is sacrificed, the point was supposed to be, and you're next, and you're next. It's not just for animals, it's for people. And you better prepare for this, because this is the entire game. So I think maybe that's why death was so central. It is the greatest event of a human's life, because when he dies, he either goes everlastingly to hell or to heaven. So death, we would like to quit thinking about it and say that's for primitives, but the truth is death is the defining moment of every human existence. So I think that's why death comes up so much. Mike?
Yeah, nothing makes sense without, you know, death and salvation.
Angie?
Very good. That's great. Yeah. So in an agricultural community, you don't want to take your best ox and kill it. I mean, that would be like you driving your car off a cliff. You know, why would I do that? But it would indicate value. And so you could see that this is supremely important. And when the Lamb of God comes, you know, supremely valuable. Josiah.
Very good. That's right. Sin is a matter of life and death. And so you'd see, you know, this sacrifice is an atonement for sin.